Steve Engelhardt. And this is the 20th anniversary of the Comics Arts Conference.
Three times.
And, oh yeah, I was quoted in the New York Times this morning. On the front. Oh, I've been quoted in the New York Times before, so.
Name dropper.
I got to talk to Tricia Helfer from This Far Away last night, so there was that. There are programs, CAC programs, back on the back table. The next panel, by the way, is the Pioneers, being 20th anniversary, is the Pioneers panel. We have the presentations available, papers and so forth on DVD available for $2. There's also some flyers back there for journals and other academically related things. We're going to, there's a great poster session later where you meet with the presenters one-on-one. We're going to save the questions until the end. T-shirts. This year's T-shirt is available down at the Comic-Con boutique booth. Black says, Scholars Headquarters, Inquiry, Explication, and Learning Department.
Where is
and
that?
It's, I don't know the number. It's next to the graffiti booth. I can find it for you. And I just want to say one quick thing before I turn the panel over to Steve and to Travis, which I was just telling Steve. My first comic book that I ever read was on a trip in 1974. I was 8 or 9 years old to California, and it was Captain America 176. Very first comic book. I still have it. And I often teach it. And the thing is, in the 92 election, Clinton, somebody else was talking about presidential candidates lying and how that was a surprise and something wrong about that. And then there was the Iranian airliner who shot down and, you know, they lied about it at first. And I thought, well, I don't understand. Of course they're lying. Like, what's that is politics. And then I had to track back why I thought that. And I realized it went back to, you know, the president, Captain America 176, being the head of the secret empire, the you know, criminal conspiracy in line. I realized that my political consciousness came from this man. I want to thank you for that gift, because it's served me well. So, I'll turn it over to Travis.
Thank you all for coming. I can't say nearly enough about how happy I am to be here with this man. He is influential in so many ways in comics, more than a lot of people realize. You know, he's got one of the most successful comic books never published. if you've seen The Dark Knight, you've seen a few hints of it here and there. Because this is the Comics Arts Conference, the academic, the scholarly track within Comic-Con, I would like to focus a little bit on what Steve's learned, not just to say, okay, what did you do and when, which is always good stuff. So your earliest jobs and your education. I don't actually know which came first, your bachelor's or your earliest job. So let's start there and then move into the comics.
Well, the bachelor's came first. I went to Wesleyan University in Connecticut and got my degree in psychology, but by the time I got the degree, I thought psychology was a pseudoscience. And,
I'm a psychologist, by the way.
Yeah, I just thought I'd drop that in there. I think my teacher was pretty good. I don't know, but I wanted to know why people did what they did, and I discovered that there's 15 answers to that, and they all work if you're a Skinnerian or if you're a Freudian or you're a Jungian or a Black Box, you know. And that didn't satisfy me, to have all those different answers. But I have found that in writing, I've been able to explore character. And so I may not still have the answer, but at least I've been able to explore all these different possibilities and try different things. But that was 1969 when I graduated with that degree, which meant that right after I graduated that degree, I got to go into the Army. I called up my draft board and I said, you know, because I'd been accepted at law school, and I said, could I get a semester in? And they said, no, that's not going to happen. So I ended up in the Army, and when I got out of the Army, I didn't really want to go back to school anymore, so I never went to law school. But I then, you know, went to New York and got started doing comic books.
What were the first comics you did?
Well, in those days, Marvel had a very successful superhero line, but they also still published romances and westerns and monster books and Millie the Model. I mean, you know, these fringe things now, but they served a purpose within the publishing thing of you could try new people there, let them learn their craft while writing a western, or they wouldn't screw up the superhero franchise. So the first thing I did was a monster story, and then I did some romances, and I did some westerns, and I did this and that, which led to my getting a chance on The Beast, an old X-Men character. And it's funny now because the X-Men are huge, but the X-Men originally had failed as a comic book. They had been canceled, and Marvel had been trying for several years to try to figure out something to do with these guys, and nothing ever worked. And they eventually took one of them, the Beast, and put him in his own book, and I couldn't sell him either, you know? I mean, so the first series that I did got canceled after 5 issues, but there was something that I was doing that they liked, and so they gave me more work. And then I got Captain America and the Defenders, and that was still, I felt like I was like in a wait-and-see kind of situation. But the next one I got was The Avengers, and that had been the editor-in-chief's book before he got promoted and needed to cut back. And it was also a very good book. And the fact that he chose me to give it to, that was when I thought, okay, I must be doing something here. And again, comics as a periodical medium, they were doing a lot of them, and they were coming out monthly, and so if you could do 2, they'd give you a 3rd one. And if you could do that, they'd give you a 4th one. And, you know, at some point I got up to 5 books a month, and I thought that was too much, and I dialed it back to, like, 4. But so I was writing an introduction for a Marvel Masterworks recently and kind of went back and looked at it. And within the first year of doing it, I had The Beast, Captain America, The Defenders, The Avengers, Doc Savage, Luke Cage, Hero for Hire. I'm sure there were a couple more. And right after the first year, I got Doctor Strange. I mean, so it was like all this stuff that, you know, I thought it was fabulous training as a writer, talking about what I learned and all that. I mean, you know, these days I'm writing books, and I've had a shot at doing stuff in Hollywood with animation and things like that. But I really love the fact that I had to come up with a new story like every week, and a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it had to work, and I had to then turn to a different character and do something else, and then a month later come back to the story that I had left and come and do some more of it. The training of get on, get off, tell a story, entertain people, and meet your deadlines and all that was fabulous. So much writing, so many things you could try, and we did have complete creative freedom in those days. So anything you thought of, you could try. If it failed, you know, I mean, the only thing that they said to me when I started getting these books was, you have to meet your deadlines and you have to sell the book. If you can do that, God bless you, you know. And if you can't do that, we'll fire you and get somebody who can do that. There was no further editorial guidance. And so people, when I decided to make Nixon the bad guy in this thing, people have said, was that hard? Did you get feedback? Was there a problem? It's like, no. All Marvel was concerned was, did the book sell? You know, was this entertaining people? So it was great training as a writer, just to be thrown into the pool and get to swim and run with it.
And what kind of is there any kind of mentorship from the other writers and editors who were involved in that?
Only the fact that you had their published work. I mean, you know, as somebody who was interested in comics. You know, I was reading all the comics. In those days, you know, they were cheap, and there were a lot of them. I mean, there was the Marvel books, there was the DC books, but there was also Dell, there was Gold Key, there was Charlton, there was Tower, there were all these different titles. They were all accessible, they were all, you could, even a college student could afford to buy them all. And so you saw artists like Russ Manning, who did Magnus Robot Fighter for Dell. I mean, that's was over on the side, and yet Russ Manning was fabulous, and so I knew who Russ Manning was, and that kind of stuff. So I had sucked all that in. Plus, I've always, you know, I was talking earlier with somebody. I mean, I'd read all the Doc Savage reprints. I'd read all the Shadow stories that were out there. People think that because I write comics and I write fantasy that I must have read a lot of fantasy, which is not my... What I was interested in actually was mysteries. I liked the plotting. I liked the intricacy of the trick and that sort of thing. But I just read voraciously all the time growing up, and part of that then became comics. And so, you know, I knew what I thought good comics sounded like. You know, I mean, so there was that sort of mentoring. But in terms of, I can remember a few specific instances where I'd go. I remember, like, on the first Beast story, I had written, you know, this fabulous prose of some sort, and I was sitting in the Marvel offices talking to Archie Goodwin, who people may know, great writer, no longer with us. And I said, you know, Archie, I'm really having a hard time figuring out where to put this balloon, how to get all this in here. And he said, well, then just strike it out. Don't put it in. And I said, well, but it's like, really, I like it. And he says, you do this job long enough, you'll be able to say everything that you ever wanted to say. So, and, you know, you'd get tips like that. People were always very generous if you had a question, but there was no specific mentoring program or any, you know, and I didn't have a mentor, per se.
And this was in the Marvel bullpen days?
Yes.
And what was that like? I mean, was it more the artist, the writers and the artist together?
Yeah, well, the Marvel bullpen was very... It was exactly what they said it was. It was a bullpen. They had a very small office. It was like at, I want to say, 59th and Madison. Their official address was like 57th and Madison, but for some reason that isn't where they were. But it was just, you know, it's like, you know, on the 8th floor or something, and if you walked into it, you would see me kind of sitting because I was being an assistant editor there to start with when they were giving me this early work. You would see me. Right behind me was a cubicle where Herb Trimpe and Johnny Romita, artists, were working, doing their regular books, but also being available for art corrections or whatever. Across from us was Marie Severin, who was the colorist. And there was a guy named Stu Schwartzberg who did the stats back when people would go into a room smelling of terrible chemicals and do stuff. And I'm sure Stu's probably suffering for having had that job. I haven't seen him in years. I don't even know if he's alive. And there was a place for a letterer. And then that blocked off the front of it. And then behind that, there were three or four sort of production guys and the guy who ran the production guy, and then there was one office, and Stan Lee was in that office. Roy Thomas, who was his second in command, was out with the production guys. But that was, I mean, you know, that whole office place was probably, if you split this room in half, all of that was probably in this section. That was Marvel Comics. And that was in 1972 when they were successful and, you know, they've expanded since then. But it was really fun. I mean, it was concentrated grouping of people who were really good at comics. Every name that I've mentioned has, you know, is like, other than Stu Schwartzberg probably, but I mean, you know, it's people who are legends now, and they were all sitting there. So again, I was in that atmosphere. If I had a question, there was no, you know, I mean, Marie Severin explained to me why Marvel Comics covers were better than DC Comics covers and things like that, but it was the bullpen that they sold you, that the whole concept of the bullpen, whatever you pictured it as, that's pretty much what it was, you know.
Now, what do you consider your own best work from that time?
Well, I have a hard time picking, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do, because writing is basically sitting alone in a room and trying to entertain yourself. And my feeling is, if I can't entertain myself, I can't entertain you. And so my job was to figure out how to entertain myself, you know, and hopefully you as beyond, from beyond that. So that any book that I got, and in those days they were assigned. I mean, it wasn't, you didn't, today you find an artist and you go and you say, I want to do a 6-issue miniseries about Batman or something. In those days, You know, they said, you're doing the Avengers now. You're doing Captain America now. And then it was up to you to run with it. So I very quickly, you know, any series that I got, I would think, what would I think would be really cool? Let's do that. And so I would entertain myself. And this is not a political answer. This is not any sort of obfuscation. But 95% of anything, of everything that I've done, I'm real happy with. And I can't really, I mean, you can say this one was more successful, or this one did this, or this one, you know, but I liked them all. There were a few where I got assigned, and I really just couldn't find the thread, couldn't find what I wanted to do with it that would make me happy. But most of the time, I liked them all. So I can't say, from that earlier period, I can't say Avengers versus Captain America versus Doctor Strange versus Master of Kung Fu. You know, they were all cool to me, you know.
Now, this sounds like it was a great, fun environment to work. So how did you end up working for someone else?
Well, politics. Yeah. You know, that's, it's always politics. And new editor. Marvel had, Stan had been the editor for years and years and years. When he moved out to Hollywood, Roy became the editor. But Roy decided he didn't really like all the business end of things. He was more of a creative guy. So then Marvel went through a period where they kind of had a new editor every year or less, because nobody really wanted to do that, you know, do the editorial job. They all came from the creative side and they didn't want to do it. And they finally got a guy who didn't last very long either, but in the process, he decided that he wanted to write the Avengers and he wanted to write the Defenders, which had left me at that point. It was Steve Gerber was writing that. But he said, I'm the editor-in-chief. I can take it. I will take it. And I said, I don't think that's the way we're supposed to be around here. And he said, I'm the editor-in-chief. That's how it is. So I said, then I quit. You know, and I remember, I really distinctly remember being on the phone, because I lived in California at that point, but I'm on the phone going, well, then I quit. And I'm like, you know, really? That's what you're doing? My wife, Terry, had traveled in Europe for a year before she met me, and I always thought that sounded pretty good. So I said, fine, then I'm going to go travel in Europe. And right after that, DC Comics called up. Jeanette Kahn had just been put in as publisher over there with a brief to, like, fix this place, because Marvel had just left him in the dust by that point. And she called up and she said, can you come over and do for the Justice League what you did for the Avengers, which, you know, I guess is, like, give them characters and do interesting stories. And we had lunch, and I said, okay, that'd be fun. I could see that. But A, I'm only going to do it for a year because I'm going to go travel in Europe. And B, I'd like to write the Batman all by himself because I really love the Batman, and this is my shot to do that. So I went over and revamped all the Justice League. And then, you know, and did my Batman thing and then left for Europe.
Because with Justice League, your approach was different. I mean, I understand Julie Schwartz had often laid out story ideas for the writers, and that wasn't what you wanted to do?
No, well, it wasn't what I had been doing. I'd had the creative freedom. And you know, frankly, they were hiring me to save the company. I mean, that's a little grandiose, but there was, you know, something along those lines of come in and change everything here for all the major characters. So I was a little worried about that. I knew Julie, and Julie's approach had been that he kind of would figure out the stories and then tell the writer, you know, here's what I want you to do. And that was one of the things I discussed, you know, with Jeanette at that lunch. I said, you know, I love Julie. I don't want to step on toes, but I would want to be able to do whatever I wanted to do, because if you want me to, like, do what I do, then I got to do what I do. And she said, okay, I'll take care of that. And I don't know what she said to Julie or, you know, what the deal was. But Julie also, you know, he'd been an agent before he was an editor. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that he took on was because he was dealing with maybe, you know, writers that weren't as into it as he was or whatever. I don't know. I don't want to malign those people. But he didn't seem to have a problem with it. And I mean, Julie and I, you know, then worked together on that, and when I came back to comics later and other stuff, he and I were always friendly. I never got the impression that he was chafing under this thing. I think he thought it, you know, he probably thought it was a little odd. And from time to time, you know, in the Batman series, I had Hugo Strange beaten to death on camera, and Julie said, you know, I think maybe if we just moved it off camera, that'd be, I mean, you know, and I'm fine. Anything that'll make my story work better is fine with me. I want it to be as good as possible. So I thought that was a good idea, and we did that. So Julie was, you know, he was involved. And I totally respected him. I mean, if he had had more things to say short of trying to take it over, you know, I mean, I would have gone with that. So it was fine.
And that Batman run that you did that time, and this is what many people consider one of the most influential runs on Batman ever. I mean, you just did it for a year. And Denny did it for a long time, and you did it for 1 year. And what did you bring to it that was different for us to be talking about of the 70-year history for that 1 year to stand out?
Well, there were three things, I think. As I say, I'd loved the character ever since I was a kid, but every once in a while they would reprint stories from the early years of Batman, 1939, 1940, and there was a real darkness to them. I mean, the art style had lots of black ink involved in it, and there was also, the Joker was a homicidal maniac, and they fought vampires, and they fought, you know, it was all this kind of, they were using the bat character motif to play with it. And then, you know, I was fortunate enough to talk to Jerry Robinson a number of times before he died recently, and you know, he's responsible for the Joker, he's also responsible for Robin. I mean, you know, they thought at some point to be more family friendly would take them more places, and apparently they were right. But I wanted to get that vibe. I wanted to get that vibe and then do a modern 70s version of it. The other thing, and the second thing I got out of that was to make the villains scary again, to make the Joker back into a homicidal maniac, because he had been, for years, he'd been like the funny clown character. They'd taken him in that direction. I wanted to make him like, you know, just a maniac. And then the third thing was, I'm always interested, I mean, the reason, as I said before, I'm interested in getting into the characters of things, and I wanted to really get inside Bruce Wayne as a person, you know, who puts on the costume, who goes out and does the thing. And the two worlds then, between going out into the darkness dressed as a bat to fight a homicidal maniac at 3 a.m. under a rainstorm, and the guy who then had a personal life, which led me to invent Silver St. Cloud as the kind of ultimate Batman woman. Strong, independent, smart, able to deal with the fact that he was the Batman, but then make her own decisions about what, you know, I mean, just all that kind of stuff. So a more human Batman, a scarier villain, and the whole darkness thing. And I just took all those and did whatever I could do with them in the course of the year that I had. And, you know, I mean, at the time, I thought, this is pretty good, you know. I was happy. Like, you know, I just said, I said, okay, this is the Batman that I'd like to see. But comics is a hybrid medium. I mean, you also have an artist involved. And the odds were at DC in those days that it was going to be a couple of guys who were past their prime, because those were the guys that were sort of left at DC. They didn't really welcome new talent at DC. They knew things weren't right, and they couldn't really figure out what the problem was. Because they'd been, you know, they'd been number one for like 30 years at that point, and when they turned into number two, they had no clue as to where they were supposed to go. A story that I didn't hear at the time. I heard this a couple years ago. You know, as many of you probably know, Marshall Rogers died several years ago. Before he died, obviously, he and Terry Austin were talking one day about their experience doing the art on that original book, and I had never heard the story. And I was telling this to somebody the other day, and Len Wein was wandering by, and he had never heard the story, and he was amazed. But when Marshall and Terry were doing the art on that Batman, they were being, every month, called into D.C. and told what a piece of shit artwork they were doing, that this was the worst stuff they had ever seen. You had to change, you had to fix this, you had to do that. Terry tells a story of they were called in, but Marshall got there early, and so Terry sat in the office outside Joe Orlando's, the art director's office, for half an hour listening to Orlando scream at Marshall. And then Marshall came out, and his face was white, and his eyes were big and all this kind of stuff. So they were doing this artwork under those circumstances. And, you know, I can tell you, if you weren't there then, as soon as those books came out, everybody said, this is, like, great. You know, I mean, fans loved it immediately. But DC didn't like it. And I come back to my point that if I had written those same scripts, and then if they'd been illustrated by a couple of board guys, you know, kind of, that would have been a completely different final product. I mean, that's the great thing about comics, the good and the bad of comics. It's a hybrid thing. And I, you know, I had gone to Europe. And so I didn't see those books until they'd all been published. And then Julie sent me a package of, like, here's how the whole thing came out. And I said, when I looked at those, I said, thank you, God. You know, it was like, because I'm leaving comics forever at this point to go become a novelist. I was writing The Point Man at that time. And I said, okay, that's the swan song in comics, and this is like really, I'm really happy with this. But then everybody else, you know, started saying, this is like really, you know, the definitive Batman, as somebody said early on. And, you know, it's... Marshall and Terry were also really into... I mean, everybody who was involved in that was the right person to do that stuff. And we liked it even then. But I don't think any of us, you know, would think, oh, well, you know, 40 years later, people are still going to be thinking that this is like something, you know...
Because during that year, and the days before, you know, social media, that series was generating a lot of buzz and excitement among people. It had a reputation for having delivered this marriage of story and art that had the feel of what if somebody were doing the kind of work that happened in the first year of Batman and Detective Comics, but in contemporary times.
Well, and that, you know, Michael Uslan, the producer on the Batman movies, said... you know, in print at the time, now I see how to do a movie for adults. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I by bringing in Silver St. Cloud, by giving him a girlfriend with whom he slept, under the comics code, it had to be, you know, but it was clear, if you were old enough to understand why a woman in a negligee would be in bed, you know, at this time, what was going on. So it really humanized Batman and opened it up beyond, you know, sort of the insular comic book world in a sense. Again, that was not, I didn't say, I can create the entire superhero film industry. But Uslan saw that he could go somewhere with that and in fact did. And so the first Batman movie, the Jack Nicholson, Michael Keaton movie, pretty much based on those stories, you know. And as it turns out, the most recent Batman movies are still being based on particular things that I did, which was not, again, nothing that I ever envisioned, but there you go.
Before a panel that we did the other day, I was explaining to someone that, you know, who Stephen Englehart was. I said, well, you know, he's one of the greatest Batman writers ever. And Uslan said, what do you mean, one of? Those weren't your last comics, though.
No.
You've done others?
Yeah, well, I did write The Point Man and sold it to Dell, and Dell brought it out and all that kind of stuff, and I got a contract to write a second book, and I was going to set it in the Silicon Valley, which was this really hot place in, like, 1981 or whatever, and I called a friend of mine, oddly enough, Ted Richards, who had been doing an underground comic called Dope and Dan, was now a honcho at Atari down in the Silicon Valley. Life is strange, right? And I said, Ted, I got questions about the Silicon Valley, you know, how computer companies work. And he says, I don't know the answer to any of that, but come design games for us. And I said, oh, no, I've got a contract to write a novel. He said, we'll give you a computer. We're talking about an Atari 5200, you know? But it's like, okay. So I sent the money back to Dell. I said, thank you anyway. And went off and designed games and worked for Atari for 2 years and came down to San Diego, actually, in like 1984 And both Dick Giordano from DC and Jim Shooter from Marvel came up and said, "You ever want to do some comics again?" And I'm like, no, I'm done with that now. And went home, and the Sunday night that I got home, I got a call from my boss at Atari. He said, "They just sold the company, and I think we're all going to get fired on Wednesday." So on Monday, I called up both Dick Giordano at DC and Jim Shooter at Marvel, and I said, "You know, I've been thinking about this." So I came back at that point and did, you know, work for both companies. I thought at least I should work for both companies because then I'm not, you know... And so I did West Coast Avengers and Vision Witch and other stuff for Marvel, and I did Green Lantern for DC. And, you know, the company has nothing to do with the product. I still, you know, again, I'm totally happy with my West Coast Avengers and my Silver Surfer and these other things from that period. But Green Lantern was my favorite of those books, you know, because there was so much mythology, so many things to play with there, which was why I got so pissed off at that movie last year. Because I said, you know, when I went to that movie, I thought, you know, it wasn't even like, for everybody else, it was just disappointing. But for me, it made me mad because I thought they had everything right there in front of them. You know, like how hard is it? It's you know, to really get the right stuff and do something with it. But anyway, yeah. So I did comics then through the 80s. And then I'd had kids in that time, and so I quit comics again. I don't know how far ahead I'm supposed to get here, but, you know, I did comics through the 80s and then gave that up and started writing YA books, young adult books, for Avon. And I had an editor at Avon who really liked what I did, and we kept doing more and more books. And then she decided she wanted to retire and become a mom. And her replacement hated what I did, and so that was the end of my, you know, my YA time. And about that time, Malibu Comics came around, and, you know, I mean, so then I went back into comics, and should I just keep going here, or what did you have, you know? And then... to be continued. No, but I, you know, I did the Malibu Comics thing, and then Marvel went bankrupt and killed the comic book industry for a while. Yeah. And Malibu went away forever, unfortunately. And then they made a TV series out of Nightman, mm-hmm. which...
How long did that last?
2 seasons.
The
series was like 97, 98, or 8 and 9, something like that. It was done by Glenn Larson, most notably known for Battlestar Galactica, the original, not the remake, but he got his name on it. The contract that I had for Nightman specified that I would get money if they did anything with the character, but it didn't say anything about I would get any work on anything they did with the character. So I had to go down... you know, I went down, my agent had to work it to get me a meeting with him because they generally don't want to deal with the original guy because he's going to get in the way of their vision for it, you know. But I went, we had lunch, and at the end of lunch he says, "Well, all right, you can write a script, and if it doesn't require like massive amounts of fixing, then you can do this." So I wrote it, and it required almost no fixing, and they, you know, so then I continued to write for the series. It was done for syndication. It was done as cheaply as possible. Even though the comic book series took place in San Francisco and the television series took place in a city that had a Golden Gate Bridge and a Transamerica Pyramid, it was in Bay City for some reason. And Bay City in the first season actually was a set in Chula Vista, and Bay City was very bright and sunny. And in the second season, Bay City was in Vancouver, and it was very dark and rainy.
It was a different season of the year.
Yeah, and after the second season, it went away. In the Bay Area, it played Saturdays at noon. I mean, I don't think it was never designed or promoted as anything more than sort of syndicated filler, you know, for your thing. But my character on television for 2 seasons, and that was fun. And I was able to come down to Chula Vista, and my family was, we were all extras in scene and so forth. So it was kind of cool. And then when that was all over, as the new century dawned, I went back and did some stuff for Marvel, but that's when, you know, the business had really changed. The whole total creative freedom, do whatever you want to do so long as it sells, that was no longer true. They'd become already more Hollywoodized, in which you had to, like, give them a proposal and tell them what you're going to do for the next 12 issues and so forth. And as I've said, I, you know, everything that I was used to doing was done in the spur of the moment, you know, the heat of the moment. And you know, I'd do that story, and then a month later I'd come back to it, and I'd go, okay, well, now what, you know, what do I want to do that's cool? If I had to tell you what I was going to do in issue 12, and then a year from now it's like, okay, this is what I have to do, I just blow my brains out, because that's not interesting to me. I would not be entertaining myself if I was having to follow some idea that I had 12 months ago about what I was going to do. So I got out of comics at that point, and, well, you know, and I mean, I did another Batman with Marshall. I mean, you know, but I was sort of, the business was, had changed, and I was seeing that, and I finally just said, I don't want to have to, like, tie both hands behind my back and try to keep doing this. And I thought about doing a sequel to The Point Man, and got an agent, and then got a publisher, and then, you know, went on and write, and now I'm writing novels.
Right, and you've got 3 in that series.
3, and there'll be a 4th one out later.
Though I heard you say you still kind of think of them as issues.
Yeah, I say that all the time. I, you know, my editor, Jim Frankel, I'm always telling him, well, in the next issue, we'll do that. And he's like, no, it's not an issue, Steve, you know.
So with these changes in the industry, it's like somebody who's wanting to get into the business now, what advice would you have to give them? Because it's so different from the work that you got to do.
I don't know that I could. In the panel earlier about the 70s, Mark Evanier quoted Jack Kirby as saying that if an artist showed him his stuff, if the guy was good, Kirby would say, yeah, go ahead. And if the guy was really good, Kirby would say, don't come near this industry. So, you know, I'm not quite that cynical about it, but I wouldn't really know what to tell people these days, because I would be advising them to go into a situation that I don't want to be in. So yeah, what could I tell them, you know? But, you know, when you get your first job, you know, when you get your first job, you don't say, well, I'd like to renegotiate the deal, you know, as you come in the door. You go, I'm just happy to be here. You know, I'm getting my shot. I'm going to build something out of this, you know. And so if the deal is inequitable or whatever, you don't care. It's, you know, it's, you're in the industry you wanted to be in. So I would assume, you know, people who want to get into comics today, they just look at the landscape and go, okay, that's the landscape I'm going to play on. But I don't know what I could tell them about it, you know.
Now, when scholars or critics or anybody else go through, you know, analyzing your work, and they're telling the world what was going on in your work, yeah, what's your reaction tend to be when you read these, or do you let yourself read these?
Oh, I'll read them. Like anything else, some people are better at understanding things than others. But at the scholars thing the other night, people were talking about this. I mean, so much of what you do, and particularly as I described it, I mean, I was working in the white hot heat of the moment, and it's very much, does this feel right? You know, it's not, and what symbol am I trying to convey here? What, you know, so I do find when, you know, not always, and not in all cases, but I mean, you know, if somebody comes along and says, well, you know, you were obviously trying to put across something. Generally, it's like news to me, you know, that I was trying to do that. I mean, you know, it's all everything's existential. I mean, there's sometimes when I do think, well, this will make a good symbol of some sort, you know, whatever it might be. But generally, it's you know, the parameters of the medium. I mean, comics. The girlfriend of a friend, way back in the day when I was getting into comics, said comic writing is like doing newspaper headlines in poetry, which I thought was just wonderful, because it's like you've got to be concise and you've got to, like, have ambiance too. I mean, you've got to do character, you've got to do story, you've got to do all that stuff, and you've got a limited space. You can't just say, well, I'll take another three paragraphs here and go upon, you know, and lay this out. So you learn to say what it is you want to say. But it's all, you know, you're looking at that page and you've got to convey your story and you've got to put it on that page and it can't cover the guy's head while you're doing it, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's really usually no trickier than that, you know, just this feels like this is going to get me where I want to go. But I don't dismiss the academic approach to it as being some pointy-headed weird thing, but it is possible to read too much into it too, you know. So some are good and some are bad is the only way I can answer that question.
All right, we have about 8 minutes for question, and his hand went up when I started the sentence.
Man, you're Dr. Strange with a Frank Dunn. That's the best thing you've done. That's the greatest thing you've done, man. Now, did that come off as being a little bit too racy for Marvel, or?
No, not really. We did a thing in our second big arc. We did Doctor Strange Meets God,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the famous one. That, yeah. Sisseneg. It's pronounced Sisseneg. This is a pretty well-known story at this point, but I mean, there were rumblings that Stan was not happy about having God in this book, and it was right around Christmas time, and I was going to fly back to Indiana, where my family is. And so I wrote a letter from a minister in Dallas saying, I'm so heartened to see, you know, this kind of thing. And when I was changing planes in Dallas, I dropped it off so it would have the right postmark. And then, you know, later Stan was heard to say, well, I got this letter and this guy, you know, he doesn't like me. So we never heard any more about that. No, we were definitely, you know, Dr. Strange lends himself to pushing boundaries if that's where, you know, if you're inclined to do so. And you know, I mean, after that, you know, he met death. He, you know, he met the spirit of nature. I mean, met himself. I mean, we were just looking to make that book as cosmic, with a K probably, as, you know, as possible.
Yeah, you didn't mention a coyote.
Right, I got him on my chest. Or a coyote. Yeah, you're right, I didn't. Well, that was Marvel. You know, I had done Coyote for Eclipse, which was an independent book, and this was the rise of the independent times, First Comics, you know, Pacific Comics, all those things. And so, of course, Marvel and DC said, well, let's co-opt that. And so DC came up with the Vertigo line, and Marvel came up with the Epic line, and they came to me and said, you know, you got something that you can do there. So I had done Coyote for Eclipse, and I thought I'd like to continue that, and I did him then for Marvel.
You got something?
Yeah, the DC Marvel, that's not really going on nowadays. It seems like a big blob. But back then, how did that come into the bullpen? How did that, did you hear any, people come around, you'd see him at a table, or something, you guys are beating us? I mean, this competition between the two, how did that express itself?
I think it was a friendly rivalry. I mean, you were on one team or the other in those days. There were only two. Well, I mean, there was still Dell and Gold Key and things like that. But in general, there was Marvel and DC, and you were on one team or the other. But you didn't hate those guys, or they didn't hate you. I mean, I had no trouble going over to DC offices and just hanging around over there, even when I was working at Marvel, and vice versa. When you, in those days, the first thing you had to do if you wanted to get into comics was physically go to New York. I mean, this was pre-internet, pre-all that kind of stuff. And editors weren't going to conventions and saying, show me your material. You had to physically be there. And there were very few people who didn't live in New York. John Severin lived out in Denver, and Sal Buscema lived in Washington, D.C. But most people lived in the New York area. Because it was a periodical medium and things were moving fast, and they couldn't wait, unless you were John Severin, for you to do something. So you had to physically go to New York. People would ask me, and I'd say, you got to go to New York. And people would go, I don't know, that costs money. I don't know. It's like, sorry, but that's the entry fee. Go to New York, find somebody's couch to sleep on, and within a couple months, you'll get a shot if you've got some talent, because it's a periodic, there's so many things going on, somebody's going to miss a deadline and they're going to say, you showed me your stuff, it looks all right, try this out, let's see how that works. The cool thing about it was pretty much everybody in comics was all living in the same area, and you got to know that you just joined the club. There was no sense of he's famous and you just got here. It's just like, no, you're a fellow comic book person living in New York, the subgenre, just like the actors in New York or the fashion designers in New York. I mean, you get your subsection of New York, and that's who we were. And so, you know, I knew everybody in comics, ranging from Wally Wood and Bill Everett to, you know, Chris Claremont. I mean, you know, it was just, we were all there together. So you couldn't very well, you know, like hate half of them. It didn't really scan, you know. But you know, when I was working at Marvel, again, very early in my thing, but Marvel finally outsold DC. And the publisher there, Martin Goodman, still at the time, took us all to DC's favorite restaurant for the celebratory dinner. DC was at 909 Third Avenue, and across the street was a place called Friar Tuck's. And so he took us all there for dinner. I mean, so there was, you know, but again, it was like, it wasn't anything mean about it. I mean, maybe from the publisher's standpoint, he really liked finally surpassing DC, but, you know, it was just all of us comic book guys who just happened to be on different teams.
One more question. One more question. Somebody who hadn't asked one? There.
Can you talk a little bit about the advantages and disadvantages of working in continuity in comics, of having an established set of premises as opposed to something that's more wide open?
Well, if you have an established set of premises, a lot of things are known already to the reader. You can just kind of like run with that. I've always thought when I was starting a new series, if I was starting something from scratch, I always see the first issue as being like sort of building the rock. You just have to kind of stand around and go, that's a microphone, that's Travis. You do a lot of like scene setting, and it's only in the second issue, or the second novel, perhaps, where you can start to roll that rock, you know, where now you've got the touchstones and you can kind of go with it. The other side of that thing is that if you're dealing with established characters and stuff, that means somebody else invented them. And so, you know, if you're writing the Fantastic Four, that means you're leeching off Jack Kirby's, you know, brilliance in order to, you know, to look cool yourself. But that's the nature of comics.
Did you ever find it impressive that you could take something in a direction, or because there was a fact or some kind of something that you couldn't do what you wanted to do because it had been said or another writer?
Not really, because you can change anything. You know, I mean, if there was something you didn't like, I'm one of those guys who, if I took over a series, I would like to take it right where it was left by the last guy. And I would usually think of something that I wanted to do that would excite me that hadn't been done. And then I would make that the first storyline. How do we get from this point to this point? and if there's something that's in my way, we blow it up or do whatever, because it's comics, right? There are other guys who, you know, sort of come in and go, I'm here now, everything's different. And that destroyed the reality of the fantasy, as far as I was concerned.
I got a call time, folks. Where are you signing?
I'm down at HH09, down in Artist Alley. And yeah,
just
come on down.
The escalator,
I'm just going to be there,
store.
So come on down.
Thank you much.